Hi, my name is Vince, and I'm an alcoholic. And I am most happy to be here this morning, and I want to thank you for inviting us down here. I want to thank Lynn and anyone else on the committee who is responsible for inviting Pat and I down to this convention. It's been a pleasure to be here. It is always an honor and a privilege to get to do this, and I don't want to forget that. It's not a chore. It's an honor. And so thank you for inviting us. It's been a great convention, and we've had a great time up until now. I don't know what the rest will be like, but thus far, it's been good. This was, I was going to start off by saying good morning, but it may be evening. I don't know. But it's good to be here. And we've had, the countdown was wonderful. People with over 50 years of sobriety, and the new people. And it is to you I will talk this morning. You who are new, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's where you are this morning, if you didn't know. You're in AA, which is a hell of a thing, isn't it? Not really what you intended, but this is where you are. You're in AA. And you'll find this confusing if you're anything at all like I was when I was new. None of this will make any sense. It's all illogical. AA is not based on logic, believe me. You'll find it's fraught with paradox. For example, you are in a room of about 2,000 people, none of whom can manage their own lives, but will be delighted to take yours on. And hopefully you will allow them to do that, because that seems to be the prescription here, is to be utterly convinced that you have no answers about what is good for you, and to be desperate enough to accept almost, and I'll tell you, if you're new here, anybody here knows more about what you ought to do than you. Almost anybody here's judgment is better than yours. So it's good if you just simply do what they say. You will be far better off. I know that's certainly my first AA meeting, which was a long time ago now. It was in November of 1965. I know, girls. I know. You think he cannot be that old. And you're right. I was only 11 at that meeting. But it was up the freeway here in Long Beach, in the Los Altos section of Long Beach, in the Presbyterian Church, on a Friday night. And it was a great AA meeting. It was a big meeting. It was a speaker meeting, and it was dynamic. And all of the AA community in Long Beach went to that meeting on Friday night. That's where they went. And they all dressed up. The ladies wore dresses, and the men wore coats and ties, and they looked good, and they sounded good, and they were tightly wrapped. The overwhelming characteristic of that meeting was that nobody looked like an alcoholic. They looked good, and they sounded good, and they all seemed as though they had well-ordered lives. And if you were to wander into that room on any given Friday night, and you were to look around in that room, and someone were to say to you, pick out the alcoholics, you would have picked no one. Except on that first night that I was there, you would have picked me. You could have definitely identified me. I had on a ripped T-shirt and a dirty pair of jeans, and I had not shaved or bathed in over a week. And I had spent the previous 5 days in the Long Beach City Jail due to a series of unfortunate circumstances that were clearly not my fault. The police department in Long Beach is fascist. I don't know if you know that. And they had abused my civil rights on a regular basis in those days. And that was the latest of those occasions. And I ended up in the basement of that Presbyterian church, and I don't ever want to forget why I was there. And if you are new, this may be helpful. I was not there because I was in search of sobriety. nor was I particularly interested in serenity or peace of mind. I was 23. If you are here and you are in your 20s and you're interested in serenity, get some therapy. You know, that's not... I wanted girls in a convertible. You know, not... So my motives were not the best. And if you are here new this morning and your motivation is less than noble, I have excellent news for you. We do not evaluate you as to your motivation here. If we did, this would be a lot smaller meeting. I will tell you that. It does not matter why you're here. It only matters that you are here. And I sat in the back of the room, up against the wall, a concrete wall in the back of the basement of this church. And I should also tell you, I'm Irish and I'm Catholic. That's funny. And I'm from New Jersey. Now that's funny. And I have great difficulty with people from Texas. We seem to have a chemistry problem or something. I guess we don't. And I sat next to this guy who was about 6'5", and he had on cowboy boots and a cowboy hat in his lap, and his name was Tex. And Tex wanted to hep me. And he told me, he said, "Boy, I'm going to hep you." And, you know, I remember thinking, why don't you go hep somebody else? You know, leave me the hell alone. But he was going to hep me. And the first thing he did was he repeated to me in rapid succession all of the AA cliches, one after another, which are really dreary, aren't they? God almighty, they're really grim. I mean, you think, easy does what? You know, what in the hell are you talking? Finally, he draped his arm around my shoulder and he said, "I keep it simple." And I thought, I'll bet you do, Tex. I clearly have no argument with that, let me tell you. And the meeting continued. And it began in much the same way we began here this morning. They read essentially what is our program. And if you are new and you wonder what it is we have, that's what we have. And if you are to recover here, it is required that you take those 12 steps. It is not suggested. That's a lie. It is required. If you take them, you recover. If you do not take them, you do not recover. And moreover, you get worse while you sit sober in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think if you're new, we owe you that information. You ought to have it today. Now, I know this by personal experience. It's not a theory. I listened to those 12 steps read at that first AA meeting, and I don't know about you, but I didn't hear anything new. I'm the end product of 8 years of Dominican nuns and 4 years of Jesuit priests. And I want to tell you, this is not new. None of this is new. It is really, I know all about these principles. I've lived within the framework of this ethic all my life. And I'll tell you what, if there's one thing I know about all of it, I am sure it has nothing to do with the way that I drink. Because if it did, I certainly would not have to go to a Presbyterian church on a Friday night to search for the answer. As a matter of fact, if you ask me, this is really superficial. It's really, really very fundamental, broad brush stuff. I mean, really, you know. And I could see, though, it might help you. If you are Protestant or not educated, this would be very good for you. But my case is clearly different. It simply does not apply to me. So I sat in the back of that room, and somewhere in my subconscious, I dismissed these 12 steps. I said, my case is different. They don't really apply to me. And the meeting continued, and it was a good meeting, and several people participated. And I don't really remember what most of them said, except that it was innocuous and inapplicable to my life, as near as I could tell. But they were really nice people, clearly. And at the end of the meeting, if I had any doubts as to whether I belonged there or not, they were cured. They had birthday parties. I mean, good God, you know. Birthday parties for a room full of middle-aged people singing happy birthday to some moron who didn't have a drink for a year, and they had a cake with a candle on it. I mean, God, it's like something should take place at a mental institution. Is it right? In the day room, you know, right before dance therapy, you know, a birthday party for the alcoholics. And they had several of these birthday parties, and one in particular for this woman who was about 110. And she was sober forever, so they had a fire on top of this cake. And she came down the aisle, and she blew the candles out, and she got up here, and she said her name was Phoebe, and that she was an alcoholic. And then she said something about, did I want what she had? Not tonight, Phoebe. And that was my first AA meeting. And I think you could safely say that I did not have a spiritual awakening. But I'll tell you what I did. I stayed sober for the next 3.5 years, right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And during that period of time, I did everything there was to do in AA. I participated in Alcoholics Anonymous on every level. I was involved in meetings. I set up chairs. I washed cups. I did everything there was to do in AA. Except one thing. I did not take these steps. And as a result, my alcoholism got worse. And it got worse while I stayed sober in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew it was getting worse. And there are people here today in a meeting this big that are precisely in that state of mind and body. You've been here some appreciable length of time, and you're very busy in AA, and you're all involved, except you're not involved in these steps, and you're getting worse. And you know you're getting worse because you are surrounded by people who are getting better. And you can watch them get better. You know they're getting better. Something happens to people who recover here, doesn't it? You can see it all over them. Their eyes change. Their persona changes. They have a sense of purpose about their life. They're going somewhere. They have direction. And you are a loser. You are consumed with resentment. And you are arrogant. And even since you arrived here, you've accumulated a whole new set of resentments. And they are the people who are getting better. And that's the way that I lived in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, on the outside, wonderful things happened to me. I was in on the ground floor of a new profession in medicine. I should tell you, I am Irish and Catholic, and I come from a huge Irish family in New Jersey, none of whom are alcoholic. Just me. The rest of them are disgustingly normal. They have nothing wrong with them. They are kind, loving, warm, successful, well-adjusted human beings. All of them. I am the fifth child in a family of 5 children. I have 4 older sisters. My youngest sister is 11 years older than I am. My father was 50 and my mother was 45 when I was born in 1940. And that was really a big deal. It was this big Irish family with all of these girls. And along came this boy. The prince had arrived. My sisters fought over who would get to babysit for me. It was during the war. They dressed me in soldier suits and sailor suits. And I had pictures saluting the flag. It would make you throw up. But they loved me. My father adored me. My father the sun rose and set on me. He loved me so much. He had this boy after all of these girls. And I'll tell you, it was just, I don't think, my father never said a cross word to me until the day he died. He just never did. He loved me so much. My earliest recollections of Christmas are my father in my bedroom in the middle of the night on Christmas Eve, kneeling down beside the bed, and he would wake me up and he would say things like, "I just saw the sleigh leave. Let's go downstairs." And the entire family would get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and go downstairs and celebrate Christmas because my father couldn't wait. So I was loved, and I was cared for, and I was nurtured, and I was not abused. And he was the vice president of a railroad, so we were privileged. We were affluent, and I had all privileges known to a human being. And I like to talk about that in AA meetings because I have been present in AA meetings, and I've heard people describe the way that they had to grow up that is unspeakable, that I can't believe it. I can't believe human beings have had to live like that and have managed to make it here. And I have literally wept listening to the horrible way that people have had to grow up. None of that is my experience. It is completely the opposite. And it tells me about alcoholism, that it doesn't matter where you've come from or what's happened to you. It has nothing to do with anything. We just represent 1 out of 10 people who for some reason can't drink alcohol. That's why we're here. We come from all different places. And my parents died within 1 week of each other when I was 12. My father had a massive heart attack on January the 3rd, 1953, and he died, and my mother died a week later. She'd had congestive heart failure, and she was quite ill for some period of time. And a week later, she just kind of gave up, and she died. And we had these two big Irish wakes and funerals in the space of a week, and it was a tough thing on me. There's no question about that. For a 12-year-old kid, it was hard. That is undeniable. But I was surrounded by this loving family, these sisters who are now had all grown up and completed their educations and married great guys and had wonderful families. And all of them surrounded me, and it was just, I was loved and cared for always. I ended up, however, going to live with an uncle, a bachelor uncle, who was 65 years old. He was my mother's brother. And he decided I should go live with him because he was he was a very powerful man. He was a politician in New Jersey. He was mayor of Jersey City for 20 consecutive years. And he was state chairman of the Democratic Party. He was a boss, is what he was. And I went to live with my uncle. And he was to see to it that I was educated and that the right things happened to me. And now, we had a communications problem. I was 12 and he was 65. And we ate at opposite ends of a long dinner table and talked about politics, which was the mother's milk of our family, and that's what we did. And I began to get in trouble. Now, I'm a very good student in school. I get A's, but I am what is known as a behavior problem. I don't know if anyone here understands that. I get in trouble. And I'm in Catholic schools, and I'm in a lot of trouble all the time. And I get in high school, and I'm in Jesuit prep schools, 4 of them, 1 every year. And that is because I'm thrown out of the one I'm in. My family has to get me in another one the following year. And they always manage to do that. And my senior year, I was valedictorian of my senior class. I had the highest grades in the class. I was number 1 in the class and due to give the address at graduation. Except I did not get to attend graduation. Graduation was in June. In May, I stole a priest's car and got drunk and went joyriding. So I did not get to go to graduation. And they told me, if we ever have a reunion, don't come. Yeah. Stay away. And that's the way that I went through school. Now, if you grew up in the environment that I grew up in, and you were time to go to college, there was only one school you wanted to go to, and that was University of Notre Dame. That's where everyone wanted to go to school in my bailiwick. Unfortunately, my family felt that that would be a bad idea for me. Notre Dame at that time was an all-male institution with strict lights were out at 10 o'clock, and if you got caught drinking, they threw you out of school. Clearly not a wise choice for me. So my family insisted I go to school in New York, and I went to a very fine university in upstate New York and spent every semester on disciplinary probation in the 60s. I don't know if you know how difficult that was to do. That was not an easy thing to do. And in the middle of my senior year, I got in an argument with my family over money. And I quit school and joined the Navy as an enlisted man. Now, I left an Ivy League university in the middle of my senior year with a 3.8 GPA in biochemistry to join the Navy as an enlisted man. It's a very bright kid. And I sobered up in Great Lakes, Illinois, in boot camp. And I remember telling they didn't call them drill instructors there, they call them something else, but I remember telling this chief, we've made a mistake here. I have a paper due next month, and I really have to go back to school. And he said, well, you're in the Navy now, kid. And they gave me a battery of tests, and I do well in tests, and I score very well. And they decided to send me to Albuquerque, New Mexico, to a guided missile program to make me a nuclear weapons expert. And then they gave me some psychological tests and decided that that was a very bad idea. And since I was a chemistry major and on track to go to medical school, they sent me to hospital corps school to make me a Navy corpsman. And I went to that school, and I did very well. And they sent me to a more advanced school where they trained corpsmen to go on destroyers that don't have physicians on them. And it's a more sophisticated medical. And I went to that school, and I did very well. And then they sent me to medical administration school, and then off to Newport, Rhode Island, to OCS, and commissioned me an officer. And now I was an ensign, and they assigned me to the 3rd Marine Division in Okinawa as a medical administrative officer. And I got to Okinawa, and they didn't have a job for me and couldn't figure out what to do with me, so they put me in an officer's club at the northern end of Okinawa and forgot about me. And quite frankly, I forgot about them. It was a mutual agreement. And my duty consisted of getting up around noon and reporting to the cocktail lounge of this officer's club and drinking Hagen-Haig Pinch, 60 cents a pop, which is not bad, I will tell you that. Yeah. And that's what I did. And pretty soon they put another guy up there. He was a surgeon out of Temple University who was had a bad drinking problem, and they did not want him around patients. So they put him up in this officer's club, and he and I bonded. We became spiritual brothers. And we both got up every day about noon and went and reported to the officer's club and drank. And nobody bothered us, and we didn't bother anybody. And we kind of forgot we were in the military after a while. We grew beards and wore shorts, and at one point had lost all our uniforms. Didn't know what the hell happened. We were kind of gone, you know, but we didn't. We just did fine. We didn't bother anyone, and we expected people not to bother us, quite frankly. That's the way you get along in life. But the regimental commander of the 5th Marines had this dinner party, this bird colonel, and he insisted that all of the officers in his command show up to this party. And so we had to shave and find uniforms and go to the colonel's dinner party. And we showed up, and he looked around the room, and he looked at us, and he said, who the hell are those guys? You know, he said, hey, two officers in his command he had never met. And he said, what do they do? And somebody said, well, one of them's a doctor. I don't know what the other one does. And he says, give them a job. So they gave us a job. They put us in charge of venereal disease control for the island of Okinawa. And our job was, the Marines would get hideous venereal disease. They would get lymphogranuloma venereum and gonorrhea and syphilis, diseases you only saw in textbooks and in Marines. Yeah. Were the only two places they ever existed, I think. And our job was to go out into the villages, to the bars, and find the young ladies in question and make sure they were, you know, it's very tawdry, isn't it, for a Sunday morning, but it's not, but now it's evening anyway, so what's the difference? Our job was to go around to these bars and find these young ladies. And so we rode in a Jeep all around Okinawa from bar to bar. And we had this power to quarantine these bars. So when they saw us coming, they would just set up the Chevy's Regal. Needless to say, we never quarantined one bar. It was just really... But you had to be careful. You didn't want to drink too much in these bars because you want these girls to start looking good to you. You know. I mean, you knew why you were there. So you walked kind of a fine line. But that's what we did. And pretty soon our naval career was over and we came back to the States. And he went back to Temple and he completed his residency in cardiovascular surgery. And he's a cardiovascular surgeon in Philadelphia today. And as far as I know, he's not yet gone to AA. If you need a bypass, I'd stay the hell out of Philadelphia. Moral of that story. I went back up to Cornell and I finished my undergraduate degree and I had applied to several different medical schools and was tentatively accepted at a couple and they felt I had social problems and was not quite material to go to medical school at that time, so I did the next best thing. I got married. You remember when you were at loose ends and you didn't know what the hell was wrong with you, but you knew something was wrong with you. You remember that point in your life and the remedy for that is always to get married. I mean, just that will fix it. And I got married and I married a girl that I'd known in the Navy, and a Navy nurse, and we came to Southern California. The idea being I would apply to SC or UCLA to medical school, and we moved in with her parents in Orange County here in Santa Ana. And I got a stopgap job as a bartender for the summer, and she immediately got pregnant. You notice how men always say that she got pregnant. You know, they always say, but she did. And we moved in with her parents, and I went to work as a bartender. And that was you can imagine how that worked out. I'd come home at 4 o'clock in the morning, and various stages of undress, drunk, and they threw me out, and I ended up on Bolsa Avenue out here in Santa Ana with a lot of Samsonite luggage and no money, and I got a job for the rest of that summer as an ambulance driver in Orange County, and I drove, and I'm a blackout drinker, so some of these ambulance calls were really colorful, I will tell you. I've been on ambulance calls with the lights and the sirens going, and I'd have to turn to the guy next to me and say, where are we going? You know, which would unnerve him, I will tell you. And one night, right here in this lovely city of Costa Mesa, I got stuck in a cul-de-sac. I don't know. You know, we had the lights going on top of the ambulance, and I came out of a blackout going around a circle in this cul-de-sac, but very slowly, you know. How you lock onto something and you can't quite get out of it, you know? And we're just going around the circle, and everybody was coming out on their porch in their pajamas and their bathrobe, watching this ambulance go around the circle in the cul-de-sac, and they finally sent a police car in to lead me out of the cul-de-sac. And they did, and I lost my job as a result of that. And I lost my driver's license got revoked forever in the state of California as a result of that. And that's what I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous, to that first AA meeting. And as a result of staying sober, a new profession had concurrently opened up in civilian medicine. It was called the Physician's Assistant Program, PAs. And a lot of you know what that is today, but in those days it was brand new, it was embryonic, and it was a new concept in medicine. And the reason for it was that in those days, in the late 60s and early 70s, all of the guys getting out of medical schools all went into residencies to specialize, and there were not enough physicians doing primary medicine in the emergency rooms. So that was the genesis of this profession. That's why they created it. And the first PAs were people such as myself who had this sophisticated medical training in the military, and we were the first PAs. I was the third licensed PA in the state of California. And I went to work in an emergency room in East L.A. nights. And I don't know, it was really a hell of a job. It was it paid a lot of money, and it was rewarding both from us and psychologically and in every way, because I loved what I was doing. And it was a new concept in medicine, and I was in on the ground floor of a new profession. I was in AA. I was sober. I met a beautiful girl, the daughter of a longtime sober AA member, and we fell in love and we got married, and she went to Al-Anon. And we were just too precious is what we were. We were really, I mean, I had this wonderful job, and she was beautiful, and we had such a bright future. Except I had not taken these steps. And there was no recovery. And I would go into this emergency room at night. And pretty soon I'd get depressed. And I'd get at loose ends. And I'd get inadequate. And not up to the task. And I have no program. And there is no recovery. But I have an excellent medical education. So I know how to take care of depression. I use Dexedrine. 15 milligram spanchels work best. And by the time I'm through with those, I'm taking 6 or 7 of them a day. And if you know anything about amphetamine abuse, you will understand that has you moving right along. Tell you what. Whatever you're doing, it will be in a hurry. The problem with that is long about the 5th or 6th day, when you've not slept nor eaten, and your eyes dilate out here like this, and your hair stands up on end. And I used to get this white crud that would come down here like this. And I'd show up in the emergency room to help the sick. And the guy I was relieving would never want to go home. You know, they would look at me and they'd say, Vince, you need sleep. Get something to eat. But thank God for medical science. There is an anecdote for that. And that is a drug called Demerol. Now, Demerol is this is an AA, I'm going to say this, we need to talk about this. Demerol is a narcotic. It's not a narcotic, it's a synthetic. I bet you didn't know that. Don't worry, you never know the difference. You don't have to worry about it. It's purely an academic. Narcotics, morphine, heroin, Dilaudid, are all the same drug. Did you know that? They all come from opium. They're opiates. They all come from the same place. It's all really essentially the same drug. And they're addictive, all of them. And they're addictive for everybody. Doesn't matter who you are. Doesn't matter. You don't even need an addictive personality. You have a syringe and a needle and heroin, and you'll be addicted. Period. That is not true with alcohol. Alcoholism and narcotic addiction are different. We represent only 1 out of 10 people. 9 out of 10 people drink alcohol with impunity. They don't ever come to AA. They don't lose jobs. They don't wreck cars. They don't go to jail. They drink. They are social drinkers. Cliff talked about them last night, and I'm like him. I don't like them. And I certainly don't understand them. But they drink with impunity. They say things like, no more for me. I'm driving, right? Or I'd love to have another, but my wife's waiting dinner, going home. Well, not me. I'm going to Las Vegas. So are you. But that's what social drinkers do. They represent 9 out of 10 people who drink alcohol. We represent only 1 out of 10. On the other hand, I have never met a social heroin user. They don't exist. The dynamic is different. And it just is. And I don't know why, and I don't know the deal, but it is. It's different. Alcoholism and narcotic addiction are not the same. Now, many of us here have experience with both. I mean, we have all kinds of things wrong with us. But to function here in Alcoholics Anonymous, you must be an alcoholic. That's who you have to be. Now, it doesn't matter what the hell else you did. As a matter of fact, it's kind of an extra added benefit, if you can write down on it. So it doesn't matter, but you must be an alcoholic. And the other problem with Demerol is that people care about where it is. You know, I tell you, you go in the emergency room in the morning when the shift changes, and they start to count the narcotics, and they open the drawer and they say things like, Vince, all the dope is gone. You know, I mean, where the hell is the Demerol? And I'd say, I don't know. And it was always a bad morning. And the end result was that, was the people who care the most about Demerol. I'll tell you who they are. The Medical Quality Assurance Board of the state of California have an absolute obsession with narcotics. They really do. And I ended up in that emergency room one night inspecting the narcotic logs. And the result of that was I was placed under arrest for appropriating narcotics for my own use and taken to the L.A. County Jail. And they, believe me, in those days they had no program for impaired physicians. The program was the L.A. County Jail. That was the program. And I was charged with a felony, was subsequently reduced to a misdemeanor, and I didn't have to go to jail, but I lost my medical license. And I ended up spending the summer of 1972 living in an apartment by the airport in Englewood, drinking 1/2 gallon of vodka a day. And I have to tell you about that. You know all about that. And I'll tell you, if you drink 1/2 gallon of vodka a day, you are an alcoholic. Social drinkers don't drink 1/2 gallon of vodka a day, none of them. And if you do, your experience is the same. The experience is uniform. You vomit bile, you lose 35 pounds over that summer, and you don't eat and you don't sleep and you're in blackouts. And if you look at a clock, it says 9 o'clock. Is that a.m. or p.m.? You don't know. Your wife leaves you and they take the furniture and the car and the drapes and the Jesus. They take everything when they leave me. I got to tell you. And I end up walking to Alpha Beta Market to buy Alpha Beta brand vodka, the kind in the wire cage by the cash register, at $7 a half gallon, to take it back to the apartment in Englewood and drink it hot. Cliff Roach likes hot vodka. He has no class. I drank hot vodka because I had to, Cliff. And I remember sitting in the middle of that dreary apartment with all of the furniture gone, with a 4-day growth of beard and a filthy Turkish bathrobe on. And I remember the doorbell rang one morning and the guy had come in to take the telephone out. And he looked around that apartment and he looked at me and he said, God, I could see the pity in his face. He said, your family left you, didn't they? I said, no, we're redecorating. I mean, what the hell are you, you know, really? And that's the way it ended for me. Now, I'm in and out of blackouts, and I came out of a blackout in Newport Beach, sitting on a bench by the Balboa Peninsula in early September 1972. And I don't remember how I got there. I became cognizant of where I was, sitting on a bench by the Balboa Peninsula in a three-piece wool suit and a white shirt and a tie, and the temperature was about 110. And I had a suitcase next to me with some clothes in it, and I don't know how I got there. I don't remember going there, but I became cognizant of where I was sitting on that bench. And I knew that I needed a job, and I went and I got an Orange County newspaper, and I looked through the ads, and I found a job as an apprentice embalmer for a mortician right here in Costa Mesa. And it, believe me, well, if you're new and you need a job, don't do this. Bad choice. But I went to work for this mortician over here on by Newport Boulevard, and as an apprentice embalmer, and it was a dreadful. The job paid $85 a week, and a fringe benefit was this bachelor apartment over the room where they kept the caskets. So you'd get to walk through the casket room every morning with a hangover, which would set you free. And I didn't like the undertaker, and he didn't like me, and we got in a fight, and I got drunk, and I stole his hearse. And on September the 20th, 1972, I came out of what I hope is my last blackout, driving the wrong way on Pacific Coast Highway in Newport Beach in a stolen hearse with a young lady next to me who I did not recall meeting, oddly enough. who was screaming at the top of her lungs. And I remember thinking, you know, I'll tell you what's wrong with me. I really have a character flaw. I always choose neurotic women. All of the women in my life end up like this. You know, I tell you, if you have a date with me, I'll tell you how it's going to end. About 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to look at you, and your eye makeup's going to be running down your face like that. You know, and I always know the date's over then. You know, it's always a clue. And she was screaming, and I remember telling her, you know, you're really unstable. You should get some counseling. Maybe you'd do better. That was September the 20th, 1972. Now, I have not had a drink of alcohol, nor have I used any mood-altering chemical whatsoever from that date to this. And, well, that's you got people 50 years sober over here. Clap for them. I ended up taking the guy's hearse back to him, and he was upset. He had thrown all my clothes out the window of the bachelor apartment, and I found myself with a cardboard box in the blacktop parking lot of this mortuary in Costa Mesa, with no money, no car, no job, and picking up my clothes and putting them in this box. And I thought, my God, what am I going to do? And I don't know about you, but every time I get in that kind of shape, I go to AA. So I reported to the Costa Mesa Alano Club over here on Placentia, which was a god-awful, dreadful, Jesus. It was grim. And I reported there for duty. And I sat at the coffee bar and I had a cup of coffee, and they had an AA meeting there that noon, and it was just dreadful. Six out-of-work Texas plumbers sitting around a coffee table talking about putting the plug in the jug. Jesus Christ, I thought, God Almighty. And then they had another meeting there that evening, and it was worse. And the manager let me sleep on the sofa. And in the morning I got up and got in a gin rummy game and won some money and rented a room on Federal Avenue in Costa Mesa for $11 a week. And if you want to know what that was like, just use your imagination. Those rooms are generic. You'll be correct. They're all the same. You know, there's a dreadful, disgusting hovel. And I moved in there and I thought, good God, I can't. I have to live here for several weeks, and I don't think I can live here that long. I've never had to live in a place like this. How will I ever? And I don't think I can live there 3 weeks. 2 years later, when I moved out of that room, it didn't look that bad for some reason. I spent my first 2 years of sobriety right here with you in Southern Orange County. And I want to tell you about those 2 years. They were the most significant 2 years of my life. Because what happened to me during that period of time changed me eventually. But I also want to tell you that I did not know that at the time. So if you are relatively new here and someone asks you how you're doing, tell them you don't know. Because you don't. Don't tell them how you feel. That is irrelevant. We don't care how you feel if you're doing it. We only care what you do. This is about action. And so I spent my first 2 years here. And if you would have asked me at any given time during that 2 year period of time, how are you? I would have told you, my God, it's awful. It's just awful. My life is terrible. I lost jobs that were unbelievable. I lost a job as a gas station attendant for being incompetent. I lost a job right down here, not far from here, in a machine shop as a drill press operator. $1.87 an hour drill press operator, where you got in there at 6 o'clock in the morning and you sat on a stool and they wheeled up a cart of copper plates and you took a copper plate and you put it under the drill and you pulled the handle, it put a hole in the copper plate, you took the copper plate and you put it in that bucket. That was it. It's impossible to do that wrong. Except I managed to put the hole in the wrong place in about 1,000 of these copper plates one day. And the foreman came over to talk to me, and he was from right outside of Dallas. And he said to me, boy, he said, we got to let you go, boy. He says, too bad, too, because I can see you're a real trier. He said, but you're really not quite bright enough to do this kind of work. And I went crazy. I said, bright enough? Bright enough? I said, you illiterate redneck. Let me tell you something. I went to an Ivy League university. I'm a graduate of Cornell, which is a bad thing to say. I said, I went to Cornell. He said, well, I'll tell you what, boy. You ought to go on back, take the course in drill press operating. And he was right. And I ended up that day going back to this dreadful $11 a week room, and it was pouring rain. And I got bronchitis, and I had a cold, and I had a fever, and I didn't have medical insurance, and I just lost this goddamn hideous job as a drill press operator. And I, going back to this, you know, what's the incongruity of my life? How did this happen to me? How could this be? And some mail had caught up with me. And one was, piece of mail was a letter from a physician in upstate New York inviting me to join a committee for my college class reunion. And I remember looking at that letter thinking, good God, how do you answer this letter? I can't make it this year, Dr. Medoff. I just lost my job as a drill press operator. I mean, you know, how the hell does this happen? The incongruity of my life. And that night I went to the big meeting in those days down here. It was at the Evel Club on Thursday night. That was the big AA meeting then. It was a great meeting, wasn't it? It was. And I went to that meeting and that night, and the speaker was the quintessential speaker in all of AA, Norm Alpe. And he was, those of you who knew don't know who that is, and it's too bad you don't, because he was, Norm Alpe was, I'll tell you who he was. If Frank Capra came up with an AA speaker, it would be Norm Alpe. He was Mr. Everyman. He was a wonderful, wonderful speaker, and he was just a guy that, I'll tell you what he had. When you listened to Norm Alpe speak, you didn't hear words, you heard music. It was the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he, because it certainly wasn't the words, he said the same thing every time. If you heard him a dozen times, you could repeat his talk word for word. But every time you heard it, it was as though this was the first time you heard it. He was a wonderful speaker and a tremendous inspiration. And every time he talked, I heard the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I listened to him that night. And I was still depressed, and I went back to that $11 a week room, and I got caught in the rain again, and I got coughed up, I got another fever, I was sick, and I got back into that terrible, crummy, horrible room over here on Federal Avenue, and I was so depressed and so desperate that I did something so stupid. I mean, I can't believe I ever did it. I got on my knees beside the bed in that room, and I said a prayer. And it was a simple, unsophisticated prayer. It was, God, please help me. I am alone, I'm afraid, and I can't make it anymore. My recovery began that night. And if you are new, that's how you begin in Alcoholics Anonymous. It is not necessary that you believe in that God or have any faith in that prayer. This is about action. It is only required that you do it. And if you do, you will get better. And you will get things in your life that you cannot possibly imagine. That is the prescription in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I began to get better, although I didn't know it at first. The next day I went back to the Ilano Club, and I ran into this guy who was sober about 11 years, and he was in the floor cover. He was from Texas. His name was Clarence. And Clarence was in the floor covering business. And he was a one-man operation. He would run down to Balboa Island and sell floor covering to the rich people. And then he'd run off to the factory and buy it and run back and install it. And he said to me, would you like a job? He said, how would you like to be my gopher? He said, I'll pay you $10 a day and provide your meals. My overhead was low. So I went to work for Clarence as his gopher. And we went and we bought floor covering and we installed it, and I carried the tools and I went and got the coffee, and at the end of the day we'd end up in Marie Callender's, we'd have dinner, and he'd give me a crisp $10 bill. And I thought, and something happened to me during those days. And I didn't know it then, but I know it now. It was the beginning of recovery. I began to take these steps, the first three. And I found myself one day down Balboa Island months later, and I don't know what happened. I mean, we got done with the day, we had dinner at Marie Callender's, and I bought a frozen banana, and I watched the sunset on Balboa, and I ate that frozen banana. It occurred to me that I felt very good, and that I was going to be okay, and I didn't have to drink, and I never had to use another drug. And I didn't know why I felt that way, because if you looked at my life, it was terrible. But something good was happening to me. I acquired some material possessions. I got a 1964 red Chevrolet convertible with no brakes and a hole in the top. I used to drive that down to the E-Bell Club on Thursday night, and I'd pull that into the parking lot, and they would immediately get into their Mercedes and BMWs and put them on the other side of the lot. They're always asking me questions like, do you have insurance on that car? You know, I hadn't had a driver's license in 3 years. Why the hell would I have insurance? I've done this thing. But I stayed sober here, and good things happened to me here. And when I was 2 years sober, I needed to get a sponsor. I don't recommend you wait 2 years to get a sponsor. I was helped by people here. There's a guy, I don't know if he's here this morning, a guy named Tom Lord, who was very kind to me when I was new. I rode around with him. He was in business, and I was a catatonic. And we rode to Santa Barbara, and we rode to San Diego, and he was kind to me, and he was loving to me. He's one of those Eskimos that are responsible for my being here and being alive, and I want to thank him. But I got a sponsor when I was 2 years sober, and I knew who the sponsor had to be, and I think that's why I waited so long to get this sponsor, because I didn't like him. He was arrogant and pompous and self-serving. But there was something about him that was indisputable. He had an amazing capacity to help losers in Alcoholics Anonymous. More than anybody. I mean, the guy had a magic touch. And he was willing to help anybody at any time. And you know what? He still is. Today. And I called him and I asked him to help me. And the first thing he said to me was, well, why don't you come up and have lunch with me at this mission I run on Skid Row in Los Angeles? So I drove my 1964 red Chevy with no brakes up to Skid Row in L.A. And I parked it in front of the mission. I went in and I had lunch with him. And I asked him to help me. And I'll never forget what he said. And if you are new or relatively new here today, I hope somebody says something like this to you someday, because it is the difference. It is literally the difference between life and death. He said, I will help you on one condition, that you can accept the proposition that your best judgment about your life is terrible, and that my judgment about your life is infinitely better than yours. And if you will do everything I suggest you do without debate, I will help you. Well, I was just desperate enough that day to make that unholy pact with the devil. I agreed to do what he said. And he had me do a whole lot of things that I'm not going to go into today. A lot of things happened to me. My recovery began. And miracles happened to me. I got my medical license back as a result of taking direction from him that was, he told me, the first thing he told me to do, I want you to live in this mission. I said, live in the mission? I said, I live in Newport Beach. Why the hell am I going to move into a mission on Skid Row? What are you, crazy? He said you'd do everything I said you'd do. So I moved into this mission. He said, I want you to come down here every day during the week at 9 o'clock in the morning. I'm going to give you an allowance. I'm going to give you $8. Put on that three-piece suit. Go outside. Get on that 83 bus that runs up Wilshire Boulevard. And get some transfers from the driver. Because every time you come to a hospital or medical facility, get off the bus. Go inside. Speak to the administrator. Tell him that you were a physician assistant who lost his license because you stole Demerol in the emergency room. But now you're an Alcoholics Anonymous for 2 years. You don't drink. You don't use drugs. You need help getting your license back, and you need a job. I thought, that may be the most horse's ass, preposterous, stupid thing I've ever heard. It was ridiculous. Now, I didn't say this to him. What I said was, okay. So I moved into that mission, and every day I reported to his office, and I got that $8. And I went outside, and I got on the 83 bus, and I'd ride all the way. I'd stop at every medical facility between downtown L.A. and the ocean. And I lived there 8 miles. I was right and he was wrong. It was stupid, just stupid. I mean, nothing ever happened to me. I didn't get a job. And I went to, during that 8 month period of time, I went to places like Good Samaritan and UCLA and St. John's. I went into the Elmer Belt Urological Clinic. I mean, I went everywhere. And I would say this exactly what he said. Then I'd go back and I'd say, see, doesn't work. This does not work. And he'd say, shut up. And I'd say, well, okay. The next day I'd go down, I'd get the $8 again, and I'd do the same thing, and I'd ride that bus. And 8 months that went on. And finally, one Friday morning in June of 1975, I went downstairs, I got the $8, I went outside, I got on that bus, and the first thing I did is I sat down on this huge wad of chewing gum all over the back of this wool suit. And I got off the bus at Western, and I went into this 76 station in the men's room, and I found myself standing in this bathroom of this Union 76 station with a three-piece suit on, a vest, a shirt, a tie, and a coat, and black socks, and my trousers in this hand, and wet paper towels in this hand, trying to clean chewing gum off the back. And I looked in the mirror, and I saw the most grotesque loser. I mean, I was 2 years and 8 months sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I lived in a mission on Skid Row. The only Ivy League man there then. I had no job, no car, no money. And I was standing like I was in some bad porn movie in a goddamn gas station bathroom, trying to clean chewing gum off my pants with wet paper towels. And I don't know if you've ever tried that, but the gum went all the way down the legs. I mean, it was a disgusting mess. And I thought, I am the worst loser ever known in AA. I mean, there's nobody ever did as bad as I did in AA. Nobody ever. And I thought, maybe if I stay, the only way I could stay sober today is if I go to a movie. So I put my pants back on, I got back on the bus, I rode to the end of the line, to the beach. And I got off and went into the Santa Monica Mall, and they had a Manning's cafeteria, you know, where you get a tray and you go get your lunch. And I got my lunch, and I set the tray down, and I went outside to get a newspaper, and the busboy came by and took my lunch. Bust the tray. I mean, that's what kind of a loser I am, I'll tell you. And I walked from Santa Monica to Westwood Village to go to the movies, and I stood in line to buy a ticket to the movie The Godfather 2. And while I was in line to buy that ticket, I heard someone call my name. And I turned around and came face to face with the administrator of the medical center in which I had been arrested in for stealing Demerol. And he said, Vince, how are you? He says, so good to see you. He said, you look great. He said, where have you been? I said, well, I'm in AA. And I'm sober over 2 years. And he started to cry and he put his arms around me. He said he was so glad to see me. He said, when have you worked last? And I said, I haven't worked in a long time. He said, well, there's an amazing thing. We have a urologist who's joined our group practice, who's a member of the Medical Quality Assurance Board. And he's going to be down in the clinic tomorrow. I want you to come down. I'm going to introduce you to him. We're going to have lunch. Maybe he can write some letters and get your license back. And if he can, how would you like a job? And I went back the next day, and I met that urologist. We had lunch. He wrote some letters. Within 60 days, my medical license was restored in the state of California. And I went back to work in the same emergency room in which I was arrested in for stealing Demerol. And I will tell you, I worked there for the next 2.5 years. And I want to tell you something. No drugs were missing. And the patients got good care. I know, because I gave it to them. And I took these steps, 1 through 12, just as they're outlined in this book. I wrote that inventory. And if you're new, you have to do it. You have to write that inventory. And there's no mistake. It's a searching and fearless moral inventory. And the word moral is not a mistake. It's not a psychological inventory designed to get you in touch with your feelings. It's not, nobody cares about that here. It is about your secrets. The dirty, filthy, nickel and dime secrets that are going to kill you. You get to give them away here. You give them away. And you walk free. And you have to pay the money back. You owe it. You have to pay it back. You are not number one on your amends list. I've got bad news for you. You're not even on it. It's them. It's what you did to them. You need to go make it right. An amend, if you're new, is not an apology. An apology is only an announcement that the amend is coming. You have to change how you live here. And that all of that has happened to me slowly over a period of time. Magnificent things have happened to me. I've made mistakes. In 1976, I met this little redhead. We met in September, got divorced in October, met in September, married in October, divorced in November. Yeah. That is a mistake. And the last time I saw her, she was on the way back to her daddy's ranch in El Dorado, Texas. So, you know, but I'll tell you what else. There was a woman who came to our group who was married to a man with lung cancer, and she got sober while she took care of him, which is no small task. And we became friends, and he passed away, and we fell in love, and we got married. And we're married for 21 years. And I want to tell you something. And I'll tell you this without embarrassment. I love my wife more than life itself. And that is a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have become a man here. And a man in this relationship. And if you are young and male here, I'm going to give you some useful information. I want you to hear it. Women are not the enemy. They are your loving, equal partners. Equal. You walk this way together. They are partners, not prisoners, not hostages. Equal partners who you love with you all of your heart. And if you do, what will happen to you here will be spectacular. In our group, several years ago, got to work with people who've had trouble with money. Started what is known as the finance class. I also should tell you that that first wife had a little girl, and she was adopted out, and I had to go find her years later. And I always regretted the fact that I never had a relationship with this daughter, but I did find her and I did try to help her, but there was no relationship there, and I always felt bad about that. But life gives you everything. Hey, Alcoholics Anonymous, the gifts are amazing. I always wanted to go to Notre Dame. I didn't get to go. But I'm a past president of the Alumni Association. I mean, it's impossible. How does that happen? But it's almost as if God said, well, here it is. You can have it. I never had a relationship with this daughter. And I started working with people in this finance class, and it seems to me that I've had this ability to deal with young women. And I've watched these immature, selfish little girls come into this class and grow into strong, confident women. And to have been a part of it is a wonderful thing. And I love them very much. They are my daughters. That's a gift. That's the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you are new here today, all of this is yours. It can happen for you. You must, but for God's sake, let me tell you this if you're new. If you have a plan... tell somebody about it. You know, don't execute it. And if you do that, what will happen to you will be beyond your wildest dreams. It's wonderful to be in Orange County. It's very special for me to be here this morning. Thank you very much.